Frosty the Snowman was a jolly, happy soul, with a corncob pipe and a button nose and two eyes made out of coal.
It's easy enough to say what mummers are not. They've got nothing to do with Santa Claus, Jingle Bells, King Wenceslas, or a baby in a manger. They're not that kind of Christmas. But it's harder to narrow down what mummers are. For instance, in England, they may sound like this. In Ireland, like this. And in Philadelphia, they may sound like this. Even in Newfoundland itself, city mummers may be different from country mummers these days.
Well, mummering is a whole bunch of things, really. One of the lectures I give my classes of Newfoundland folklore is about the variety of mummering, about the variety of Christmas, because there's so many things, and some of them grade into what we think of as mummering, and some of them go into other things. But at core, mummering is the practice, usually during the 12 days of Christmas, the days from Christmas Day through to what's called here Old Christmas Day, or the Epiphany, the practice of dressing up in some kind of clothing or masking to simply hide your identity, and then going to people's homes and coming in and entertaining and being entertained. And usually a game ensues of trying to guess who you are.
So let's start out with some out-of-town mummers.
You want some debt? You want something over there?
There.
There you go.
What's this boy?
You're not backwards. I'm
afraid of
him. It's supposed to be.
This is John and Rita Chidley's house in Renews, a small outport 90 minutes drive south of St. John's. The Chidleys and a few friends are getting ready to go out mummering tonight, and they're in the kitchen rigging out in outlandish disguises.
You know, it's been part of our history for possibly hundreds of years. I can never remember not having a Christmas that never took place, that the mummers didn't come sometimes during Christmas.
Katie, what are you going to do with your hair? Anyone sees those locks, they're going to know who they are.
Daughter Katie has flaming red hair. She'll be instantly recognizable if she doesn't find a way to disguise it.
Disguise is the word, yeah, because masquerade suggests that you're dressing up as someone else or something else, whereas these really are meant to disguise your bodily being. And disguise runs right through everything. You disguise your face, obviously, by pulling something over it, a bag, a mask, whatever, a box. You disguise your bodily shape by stuffing things into your clothing or some other person's clothing. You disguise your gait, you know, might walk with a stick in order to give yourself a funny gait. And you disguise your voice. So people will often talk about what they call mummer's talk. Mummer's talk is what linguists call ingressive speech. It's where instead of talking as you breathe out, as I am now, you talk when you're breathing in, as I am now. And it totally disguises your voice. It's probably one of the, I'm sure it's one of the very few examples of ingressive speech in the Western world.
Most people in this community know you.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you get around that?
You disguise your voice, and you dress up, you cover your face, and you have to just
take off anything that might give you away.
Cover your hands, change your footwear.
Change your voice, and that's the time you would talk, breathing in. Anyone's allowed in! That kind of a way. And if you couldn't disguise your voice very much, you just wouldn't say very much. You'd just nod and shake your head.
Yeah, you had to be careful, because especially some places you go into, people even know your footwear and that, so you had to disguise everything about your, even your features. And
you very seldom you ever lift your mask. You had to leave. If you didn't guess you, you never lift your mask. You had to leave, you never guess you.
A pillow slip, cut with two eye holes, makes a kind of a hood.
That's right. That's why they had them like this, see, because you can put in the drink, see?
The advantage of this kind of mask is that if someone offers you a drink, you can slip it up underneath and get it to your mouth without having to take the pillow slip off and revealing your identity.
Well, get ahead, I'll tell you that.
What do you do? What are you going to do tonight? What's the game plan?
What is the game plan? Well, I don't know. Well, first thing we're going to get dressed here, and we're going to get our costumes together, and then we'll try them out, and we're going to visit our friend Paul, who's just in the road, and
we probably drag him in with us too. We'll drag off a few people as we're going and making our ways for the night and visit some elderly people, and we'll end up with a party later on tonight that there's a number of people in, and other musicians from the community will be there. And what do you think, Beth? Sound all right to you?
Yeah, sometimes it has a snowball effect.
Yeah, so
sometimes
yeah.
when you go there, they don't join you, they just send you on your merry way. But in other places, the couple may dress out and go with you.
Any songs you're going to sing or anything in particular? Do you have to plan to do anything, or are you just...
Well, we had no plans, but we have a sort of... play by ear, take it as... One thing doesn't work, you try something else.
Yeah, it depends on the places that you go and what kind of a reception you get. And stuff like that.
Poverty looking. No, I thought I was
going to miss. Bev struggles into a pair of purple long johns and stuffs cushions down the front. She looks like a cross between a snowman and a pregnant camel. Katie's decided to hide her red hair under a tablecloth. John covers his face with a black veil, shrugs on somebody else's jacket, and tops it off with a woman's hat worn inside out. Just about everyone covers their hands with someone else's gloves, mostly mismatched gloves. It's quite likely that hands will be examined in the houses they visit to see if anyone can recognize wedding rings, for example. Vests are put on backwards, some men wear skirts, and you can't see anyone's face. If you went out on the street like this in Toronto or New York, people would think either you're planning a bank robbery or you've just escaped from a psychiatric institution. So now that everybody's disguised, where to?
Let's go up the park.
Then they're going to a party. What time is it?
Where's the party, though?
I don't know what time it is.
Okay, we'll have to go to Pogues'.
Come on, now don't go getting tangled.
Eventually, it's decided to go to the house of the local member of parliament.
I think you have a right, you feel a right, to be able to get into any house you want. Now, most, in practice in Newfoundland, most mummers looked for houses they knew they'd be welcome. They weren't going to waste a half hour at some dry household, if they're interested in drinking, when they could be at some wet household and get a drink. So, and they'd find those things out. They'd make sure that if there was a particular tragedy in a home, you know, and it was appropriate then to go in there, or if it was inappropriate, to avoid them. I don't think there was ever any kind of universal rule about, you know, who should let you in or who shouldn't or who couldn't or whatever. I doubt there's any universality to mummery in any way, for that matter.
Merry Christmas.
And having all these people come to your door who are dressed up, in a way there's a thrill in that isn't there when people are coming that you know immediately because perhaps you've invited them, and certainly their faces bear, you know, you know who it is. So I think that adds to that kind of thing, and it's a very different social scene than a cocktail party. For another thing, it's a kind of a serial party. You'll get a small group of people coming to your door. They'll sit down, they'll hang out for a while. They may go through the whole process of guessing, you know, who's under, or you may go through the whole process of guessing who's under those bags. And then they'll head off again after a certain amount of time, and then perhaps somebody else will show up. So it's a kind of, I'm thinking, you know, of a thing in several movements, you know, whereas a traditional kind of urban party is everybody shows up at more or less the same time and everybody leaves at more or less the same time. So it's a very different, more controlled sort of thing in a way.
Now, anybody wants a drink, you have to sing for it.
Oh, my God! Where's you?
Some of you can
sing. Right here! Drink!
Oh, right, oh, yeah!
But you don't have something to drink? Drink
Pretty soon, the guessing starts.
Do we know any of those guys, Lyle?
Who are these masked visitors?
You know it well.
We know you well. We know you well. Usually I know faces.
Okay, we'll turn up the. Put in a few more junks, like I said. Turn up the heat.
Turn up the heat, the host says. It's an old ploy. If the mummers get overheated, they'll have to take off their masks.
Are you dying with the heat?
David, we need some ice.
I should know.
Come on, guys.
David, come on. See if you can figure out who he is. And you should be able to see through these lace things. Come on and see if we can figure out who they are. I can't stand it.
So disguising voice, body, face, everything.
Mm-hmm.
Why? I mean, is there a social function to this?
That's something that people have puzzled over, certainly for 40 years, that scholars have been writing about mummering. This idea of the stranger is really important. And sometimes in trying to figure out who a particular mummer is, there'd be certain questions that'd be asked. One of them is, where are you from? Where did you come from? And one of the traditional answers is, oh, I'm from the North Pole, except said in that funny voice. And the whole idea is that, you know, I'm not from around here. I'm from somewhere else, which is in a way a kind of a threatening thing. So, you know, the stranger is a threat. Well, strangers in a small community, which doesn't see a whole lot of people coming through, are threatening. And so the mummer is at the one time threatening, but at the same time, he's also clearly a local in some way. You know, he's doing the local thing. You know, everybody knows that Newfoundlanders go mummering, but almost nobody else does. So, you know, they must be at least familiar with Newfoundland. Children are often really afraid of mummers, and the reports of mummering going back 100 years often point out that children just draw back from any mummer that gets close to them, often bursting into tears or running out of the room, and often children are teased by the mummer. So this whole idea of fear, strangers, and mummering, these are all tied in together. I don't think there's any single way that you can pull it out and say, you know, the mummer is always the stranger or you're always afraid of the mummer, but it's one of the threads there. I think the reason why people do it in 2005 is different from the reason why people were doing it in 1966, and that was probably different from why people were doing it in 1896. So, and this is true of a lot of folklore, that it's carried on, it's successful over time, because different generations and different people within the same generation find different reasons for doing it. So there have been lots of explanations. Jerry Sider, a Marxist anthropologist, looked at mummering in Dunville in Placentia Bay and decided, and probably quite rightly so, that it had to do with the way men were working out who they would fish with in the following year and trying to make connections among, make new friends, essentially, for economic purposes. You know, I'm sure that's what he saw. However, I don't think that that's a widespread reason for why people go mummering. And it doesn't explain all the people who aren't trying to make up new fishing crews. They're not doing it for that. Other people do it because it's... that's really what you do for social reasons. That's how you keep your friends, your friendship circles, you know, turning. That's how you you pay back friends who've entertained you. That's how you show yourself to be a sociable and laughing sort of person. And
but you could do that by having a cocktail party. You don't have to, you don't have to go to this much trouble.
That's right, you could. Well, I guess it's a matter of what is culturally appropriate. The mummering tradition has grown up as something that's appropriate here.
Yeah. I would take him out with and he's so, yes, boy, for the love and honor of God, but he's up your mouth.
I hit the nail out, but I'm nearly busted.
Eventually, the heat in the kitchen, and maybe the rum, makes everyone take off their masks, whether they've been guessed or not. And pretty soon, it's off to the next house.
No, nowhere else in the world that they believe something like this could
eat. Now, the group is bigger. A guitar player and a couple of others from the first house have put on disguises and are tagging along. And the guessing starts all over again. But in this house, John is outed right away.
John Chidley.
Where?
John, right there.
How do you know that?
Because I knows his eyes. I knows your eyes. You can take off your mask. Dad, take off your mask because I knows it's you.
And now it's short work to guess the others.
Eugene.
Except for the guitar player who tagged along from the last house.
Who's this? A guitar with her.
Yeah.
You'll never guess a millionaire.
You'll never guess a millionaire.
No, I bet you won't guess either.
On that? I don't know.
You know him.
He definitely
knows him.
He staggered your young fellow's age, thereabouts, no?
No, younger than that.
Younger, he's younger. You're younger.
Younger than that, too. Although he used to be down there hanging around.
now. Like the Tomcat sniffing.
Down there! I used to be down there.
This came here with the English and Irish. Settlers, presumably, originally. If I could time travel back to Europe, 500 years ago, a millennium ago, would I find, do we know, would I find the sort of prototypical mummers wandering around at that time of the year too?
Some people like to kind of romance the history a bit and say that mummering, as we know it in Western Europe, and Newfoundland is really one of the Western European mummerings, it came out of the ancients, particularly the Romans' festivities at that time of the year. It's really hard to say that that's the case. There's lots of local seasons of revelry in Europe through the Middle Ages. One of them is that which grew into the modern forms of Mardi Gras, the whole season of Shrovetide. Shrovetide was a period of great revelry, drinking, amorous exploits, food, violence, all sorts of things. Many things which turn up then in Christmas revelry later on in the mummery. It's hard to say that there's any kind of connection back through. We can say that, yes, there's this and it looks similar. There's this over in Poland, this in southern France, and this in Denmark, and so on. And they all seem closely related. But they're separated by centuries in a lot of cases, and we've got nothing to link them. I think there's a natural need for people to break out of routine, and we see that in lots of ways today. And I think mummering was one of those ways, and Shrovetide things was another way to do that.
Sit down, give us a sign.
You lost your head, lamp, and don't
know.
You lost to me, Lily.
I saw you once.
He said, let the stridlings are good looking. Not low, it's not low. You lost to. You know,
Why is it you find it in Newfoundland and not in the rest of North America? Did it make it to the rest of North America?
Yes, in different forms. So, of course, you have, many of the people listening to this will say, well, what about the Pennsylvania Mummers Parade? And they're absolutely right. In Pennsylvania, every year on January 1st, there's a big parade. That's very different from, that's like the difference between a birthday party and the Rose Bowl parade, in a way. You know, it's mummering in Newfoundland is something done in people's kitchens. The Mummers Parade on New Year's Day is a huge, big deal. It's there's a lot of money and a lot of planning and choreography and everything else that goes into that. So, but that in its roots is the same thing, and that's why it's got the same name. As well, the Germans who settled part of the south shore of Nova Scotia around Lunenburg County brought with them a thing called Belschnickeling, and Belschnickeling was identical to mummering at the beginning of the 20th century. There was no difference between that and what Newfoundlanders were doing 600 miles away in Newfoundland. It died by probably the beginning of the 1950s. The thing is, though, Newfoundland was settled at a particular time, and many of the people who came to Newfoundland came well before the 19th century, the families did, and brought some of these customs. Well, back in England and Ireland, these customs were already in decline then. And the draw of the population out to North America, in fact, was from different areas of England and Ireland than the draw out to Newfoundland. So Newfoundland was settled in large measure by people who came from a little circle, perhaps 20 miles across, around the city of Waterford in Ireland, and another little circle around 20 miles around the city of Poole in England. So that represented a pretty narrow range of customs. Our earliest references to kind of Christmas revelry in Newfoundland, although it certainly was predated in Britain and Ireland, is the late 1700s. And then we get some really good descriptions of mummering through the very early part of the 19th century. So we know that for 200 years it's certainly established here. It's like so many other bits of informal culture that we folklorists are interested in, that by its very informal nature, it's poorly documented. And it's only later on, during the 19th century, when the educated classes start saying, oh, look at this, what these people are doing. You know, that's very quaint. You know, I must write this down and write it to my colleagues in, you know, wherever, and tell them about it. And so we get these reports by missionaries, by educators, by, you know, people like that, people who are educated and who are sending reports of life and culture in Newfoundland out to other places like the United States, like Great Britain and so on.
Reverend Lewis Anspach, 1819. A custom which is said to still be observed in the north of England prevails in some parts of Newfoundland, though not with general approbation. It's called mumming. Men and women exchange clothes with each other and go from house to house singing and dancing, on which occasion Christmas boxes are expected and generally granted previous to the performance in order to get rid of them.
Joseph Beat Jukes, 1842. On my arrival at St. John's, this was the season of general holiday. The lower orders ceased work, and during Christmas they amused themselves by what seemed the relics of an old English custom, which I believe was imported from the west of England, where it still lingers. Men, dressed in all kinds of fantastic disguises, and some in women's clothes, with gaudy colours and painted faces, and generally armed with a bladder full of pebbles tied to a kind of whip, paraded the streets, playing practical jokes on each other and on the passers-by, performing rude dances, and soliciting money or grog. They called themselves fools and mummers.
That mummering survived in Newfoundland for centuries might not be surprising, except for the fact that it was illegal for most of the past 200 years. The Act to Make Further Provision for the Prevention of Nuisances was passed in 1861. It states,
any person who shall be found at any season of the year in any town or settlement in this colony without a written license from a magistrate, dressed as a mummer, masked or otherwise disguised, shall be deemed guilty of a public nuisance, and may be arrested by any peace officer with or without a warrant, taken before any justice of the peace where such a person may be found, and on conviction in summary manner be committed to jail.
Why was it banned back then?
Lynn Lundy is an anthropologist who's also been an illegal mummer.
The thing that I think is dangerous about mummering is that it's a masking and disguising tradition. And people go about at night. You have to remember what had happened in Newfoundland prior to the 1860s was there was a heavy migration of the Irish into Newfoundland to service the migratory fishery, which was shifting over to a settled fishery at that point in time. And they were really crucial in making that happen because they provided the base labor. So they were an important group of people to have here. But they had also, in 1798, been involved in the Irish uprising, which was directly against the British and in conflict with the British. So there was a distinct animosity between these two groups of people. It was along ethnic lines and it was along religious lines. Now you get them here. Again, you have the Irish as the servants, the people who are the laborers, and you have the British being the people who control things. They're running the government, they're running most of your merchant establishments. So you've got this animosity and this political and economic division that has come over with everybody from Ireland and England. And in Harbour Grace and Carbonear, there's been some research done during the time period from the 1830s to the 1840s, in which there was a lot of social unrest.
We know that the earliest good reports of mummering in Newfoundland involve mummers carrying sticks, chasing people through the streets, of being allowed by tradition to hit people who weren't dressed up as mummers.
From His Majesty's Magistrates Harbour Grace to the Colonial Secretary St. John's, January 1831. Some persons in Carbonear have had lime or flour thrown on their clothes by disguised persons when going to attend divine service. These mummers appear in the streets with their faces blackened or covered, also men dressed in women's clothes and of the lowest order of persons. We humbly conceive that it would be much for the benefit of the public peace of Conception Bay that the practice of mumming should not in future go unpunished.
There's a name for one kind of mummer, the tag or the take, the tag, from Conception Bay. And the last night of mummering was teak night or tag night. And the mummers who were out that night had the right to hit non-mummers. They could tag them. In fact, the name tag goes back somewhat further. It's one of the dismissive names for Irishmen that English people had, the tag, I suppose making fun of a certain vowel that Irish people would have had. And it was seen in many parts of Conception Bay as an Irish thing to do, to go mummering. The Protestants didn't. It was exactly the reverse in some other parts of Newfoundland, by the way, so you can't make a cross-the-board judgment that it was the Irish settling in Newfoundland who brought mummering. I think it came from both the English and the Irish. However, that fact that in some communities you had this line between the non-mummers who were one religion and the mummers who were another religion at a time, the 19th century, when there were lots of ethnic and sectarian strains, I think that probably led to violence more often than we know about.
At 1 o'clock in the morning of the 7th instant, most daring outrage was made by persons disguised as mummers, with their faces blackened or covered, at the house of Manuel Alcock, a respectable planter in this town. A subscription ball was given at this time by a party of respectable persons, when some of these delinquents entered the house armed with bludgeons and swabs dipped in blubber. They first beat in most inhuman manner James R. Thompson of this town, dealer and chapman, and covered his clothes with blubber. The next attack was made on Henry Stowe of this town, Master Cooper, who was in the kitchen, and beat him severely and covered his clothes with blubber.
It's interesting to look at reports of mummering, not just in Newfoundland, but also in the West Country and in Ireland, where you see very strong class divisions there, where the mummers would show up at the homes of the people who were economically better off than they were, expecting to be entertained in a way that upper class entertained itself. And I imagine that kind of strain was common. And the magistrates, of course, would have found themselves on the side of the better off more often than the sides of the less well off.
These delinquents destroyed two sets of chinaware with some dozens of glasses and earthenware, and also two tables on which there were articles of food and victuals prepared for the guests. At the same time, their disguised companions outside of the house broke the kitchen window and sash thereof.
What was threatening to the middle classes that were developing at that point in time, especially in Harbor Grace and Carbonear, which were second only to St. John's in terms of mercantile interest, was the fact that you had this social unrest that was occurring. And one of the means to get against a group of people who are very powerful is to mask and disguise. If you can't win in the courts and you can't win in the legislature, what are you left with?
After the parlor windows had been so broken, three guns were presented through the windows, which so terrified the females, some 14 in number, that some of them fainted.
Editorial, The Public Ledger, January 4th, 1861. The condition of Harbor Grace just now is a deplorable one. The peaceful and respectable inhabitants being at the mercy of a lawless, ignorant, and brutal populace. None but these ruffians dare go abroad at night. It is a raid of low, savage Roman Catholics upon the Protestants of the town. Law, order, decency, propriety, respect, and every moral and social and legal feeling is thoroughly abandoned, and the lord of misrule reigns paramount. Martial law is an extreme measure in any community, but there really does seem to be great necessity for it in Harbor Grace.
The day after that editorial was published, January the 5th, 1861, a man named Isaac Mercer was killed by Mummers.
We know, of course, about the celebrated case of Isaac Mercer's murder by Mummers. And of course, I mean, if you put yourself in the role of government officials at that time in 1861, and it makes a whole lot of sense that you'd say mummering is very dangerous. You know, here we are in a time of heightened sectarian tensions, of violence coming up in various ways, of threats, and now we have a murder. You know, and so as a result of that, mummering became essentially illegal, and it was illegal for several generations, although in most parts of Newfoundland that illegality was just completely ignored. People continued to mummer.
Did that change mummering in Newfoundland?
I think it did, yeah. One, it reduced the amount of violence, the amount of public performance. In the middle of the part of the 19th century, there's a great deal of public performance of mummering. So there was the Mummer's Parade, for instance, in St. John's, which some descriptions have it as being a couple of miles long and very straggly. And once it became illegal, the urban style of mummering, which included all this public performance, really withered away. And any other kinds of public performance started, it became a more private thing to do. Because people knew it was illegal. They knew that it was kind of a dangerous thing to be doing. And so they kind of quietened down. But that was as a result of violence. And yeah, even today, I'm sure there are a lot of people who just wouldn't open their door to strangers. The mummers. It doesn't matter that it's Christmas and they're dressed up like mummers. You know, they just, I don't know who you are. You're not coming in here.
The Newfoundland mummering ban stayed in effect for 130 years. It wasn't repealed until 1992. And although the tradition stayed alive in outport communities, city mummering became non-existent. Almost.
Ah! You were just saying.
I left my bow up.
Did I get you?
Do you feel bamboozled?
In a house in downtown St. John's, a gaggle of city mummers get rigged up. Some of these people have gone mummering here for 30 years, and they do something different from the folks we left in Renews. These mummers go into houses and perform an ancient ritual that's almost like a play. There are characters with rhyming lines that have been passed down through the oral tradition for centuries.
Sir Richard Bonnycastle, St. John's, 1842. There is a sort of Saturnalia amongst the lower classes in St. John's, commencing at Christmas. The mummers perform, at those houses which admit them, a sort of play, which is very long and tiresome after once hearing. It is a dialogue between the captain and a sailor. They are both armed with swords, and a mock fight goes on until one is supposed to be slain, when the doctor is called in to bring him to life again. I cannot recall the doggerel used, but it is a relic of the days of the Abbot of Unreason and the Lord of Misrule.
Once widespread around the island, by the mid-20th century, the ancient mummers' play had been mostly forgotten, except by a few elderly performers in outports like Port Curwen, where this recording was made 35 years ago.
Oh, yes, George King George, yes. Yes, he was captain. He was skipper, we called him. There'd be another fellow who'd fight again, you know, and he'd fight and make out to go and stab one another and everything like that. Big fight. You have to act it.
It's a long way to remember.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. I suppose maybe about 60 years ago or 70. Yeah. Long spell ago. That's somewhere out, I think, there was a sickness or something going around and didn't get to go far at all. Had to knock it off.
The drama that the late Paddy Reddy was describing is the same ritual these city mummers are gearing up for in St. John's tonight. There'll be a traditional cast of characters, King George, the Turkish knight, a doctor, and Father Christmas, and they'll perform a battle between two forces, one light, the other dark. One will die, then be brought back to life. Why? Because it's always been. Certainly for centuries, and maybe for much longer. It may reach all the way back to primitive winter solstice rituals. But why would people do this in the 21st century? Tonight, in a mask, white veil, swimmer's goggles and skirt, Fabian O'Keefe will play the part of the Turkish knight.
I go mummering every Christmas because I enjoy it. It's not to preserve the culture or the heritage. It's not for the free drinks or the opportunity to be outrageous. It's just there's a potential for a great deal of fun to be had by all. And I suppose what we do whenever we go into the house, we're hoping to share that sense of fun. And I assume that's why it was done eons ago.
My name is Michael Rossiter. I'm 26 years old, resident of St. John's, and a mummer. I mean, just to look on people's faces and the reaction that you get out of them, you know, it's performing something special in their living room, then you feed off each other and you both know it's special. And it's certainly like the fourth wall is taken down in the theater sense. And the audience and the performer, you know, has a real connection because you're both on the same wavelength and feeling that magic, that specialness of it all, you know, that moment, I guess.
It's alive. Okay. And we know what the tradition is and we borrow from the tradition, but we're not slaves to that tradition. Mummering has certain rules and we try to play within those rules and then push the envelope a little bit.
I have no view.
So yes, well, we should be keeping an eye out everywhere we go.
If we were going to be really legitimate.
Because we could pass a party between here and the...
Well, there's lots of lights on over there.
Don't draw so fast.
Yeah.
That's decorations, though. That's the way it looks every night.
They start pushing the envelope when they pile into a van and start cruising the city streets. Because they're not going to friends' houses.
I suppose sensible people would walk to the homes of people they know, but it seemed much more exciting to go into strangers' houses because strangers will not be kind to you. And there's nothing worse than performing at your great aunt's house and she holding a frozen smile on her face until she can finally exhale and thank you very much. Where if you go into the house of a stranger, There's shock and awe.
Well, there's people right there. Oh, there is people on the doorstep of that house. Look, three or four houses back now.
Where?
Well, yeah? No, three or four houses back now. People were on the doorstep.
Turn around. How do you find a stranger's house? Well, you know, you look for cars. You look for footprints in the snow. You look for a bunch of heads in windows. And you assume that's a good house. So, you know, you've got to barge in and hope that people recognize it for what it is. A little gift of Christmas.
Okay.
The sun will shine. We have
My name is Paul Turner.
And I'm Velma Turner.
It was perhaps 10 o'clock, maybe 10:30 in the evening. You know, we were here in the house. The house was lit up fairly brightly. Music was playing. And I remember standing up close to the stairway that goes down to the main door. And out of the corner of my eye, I caught sight of the front door opening and people starting to pour in off the street dressed in costumes.
So they didn't knock?
Oh, absolutely not. They just opened the door and walked right in.
We just left the door open and in they came.
Room, room, gals, room, room required here tonight. For whether we fight, stand, or fall, we'll do our best to please you all. But give us in comes I, Father Christmas. Welcome or welcome not. I hope old Father Christmas will never be forgot. Now strike a fire, light a light, soon there'll be an awful fight. If you do not believe what I do say, step in, King George, lead the way.
Because the mummering, what most people call mummering now, tradition, we'd been exposed to it when we were younger, we didn't think it was all that strange. We were curious, and it was exciting. It wasn't until they were actually here and we realized, A, that there were so many of them, and B, that we had no idea who they were. A little bit of concern about, you know, the fact that you had a bunch of masked and costumed strangers right in the midst of your house. As
these
well,
people were all dressed up. They were masked.
Oh, yeah, and there was
we didn't know who they were.
In Turkeyland, I'm ready to fight. Where is the East? I must find the East. I cannot smell East. I smell yeast. That was a long blow. I do not wish to bring up personal matters.
You have an affection for yeast.
Then the actual play itself started, right? And once that happened, they started to go around and actually work, you know, the different parts of the play, starting off with the Turkish knight and, you know, the king and the killing and the doctor coming around to try and revive it and those sorts of things. And the way that they were going around, interacting with us while we were watching this.
We arranged this night.
All together.
I'm Gordon Jones. I teach English at Memorial University. I'm not a folklorist, and I'm involved in theatre, so I suppose I tend to look at it as a folk ritual, and as an important folk ritual saying important things about life and experience. There's a kind of edge to it. It's funny, it's bizarre, it's irreverent, but there's also an edge of threat in it, I suppose, by virtue of the nature of the narrative, which is about death and resurrection. You've got a combat, a life and death combat in the middle of the play, a comic combat, admittedly, but a life and death combat. You have the doctor and the resurrection, the bringing back to life, which is an interesting motif and something which touches on deep human sensibilities and hopes and fears.
You talk about there being a death.
Yes.
A lot about death in this.
Mm-hmm.
Why would people want to do a ritual drama about death at Christmas, and why would people want to see it at Christmas?
I think you're now starting to move into the area of kind of seasonal rituals and rituals to make the sun rise again in the following day, rituals to drive away evil spirits, and the blessing of the house at the end of the play is a kind of attempt to drive away evil spirits. Perhaps it's something like a carnival bonfire in the middle of the darkest season and the longest days. Lighting beacons to drive away the spirits.
Ladies and gentlemen, see what I have done. I've cut him down like the evening sun. His body is dead.
What have you done now?
Well, I killed him.
Ashes to ashes, dust to dust, I'm afraid it's...
Gone to rough.
They'd run over like the doctor, right? You know, had this wonderfully graphic male genitalia stapled to the front of his pants, and he'd run over to the women, right, and ask them if they wanted to have some of his, I'm trying to remember the phrase, inky tink, and make some comment, and then someone else would come over and drag him away from the women as they were laughing. I mean, it was really well done. They'd ad-libbed a few little parts, right, about local things that were happening at the time, like a few little satirical and political remarks that had worked into the show. By the time they'd finished, I started to grab glasses and, you know, grab the liquor and start offering them a drink to see if they'd wanted one. And from that point, the performance sort of stopped. And although they never, ever revealed who they were or where they came from or anything like that, you could tell the instant you started talking to these people outside of the performance itself. Like, I mean, you know, this was a class act.
But, you know, I mean, if this... In New York City, if somebody walks to the front door with masks and sticks in their hands, I mean, they'd be shot dead on the front doorstep.
Probably so, yes.
I mean, why would you trust them? You didn't know who they were. People walked into your house. They didn't even knock. They just, I mean, what possessed you to let them in?
I think in the first place, I guess it's cultural. If I had been raised in New York City and had never been exposed to anything like that before in my life and a crowd of masked people came into my house, I'd probably be reaching for some sort of a defensive weapon myself. But where the local culture has a tradition of those kinds of visits at Christmas time, and plus it's not a horribly violent place, like it's not a gun culture, it's not a culture that has a large degree of break and entry or violent theft, and the fact that we had the strength of numbers,
there was twice as many
of us as there were of them,
yeah.
Right?
If it came to a fight.
If it came to it, yeah, we could have forcibly thrown them out if we had to.
Was the master of this house and the mistress also, and all the little children around the table.
It speaks to our sense of community that people are intimidated, certainly, by the idea that strangers in masks are coming into their homes. And certainly the performers are intimidated, the idea of going into strangers' houses and not knowing really what's going on behind those doors, what types of characters are in there. But we're still, I suppose, a community small enough and trusting enough that the performers will go in and the audience will let them. And I guess that's what heralds back to what started mummering, I don't know, 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, I don't know, how far back does it go? I guess those are the elements of Christmas, as a professor at the university called it, the super visit, the going door to door and wishing well and a blessing and giving a gift to someone, something that's unique, something that can't really be store-bought.
It was pretty rich and intense, and it left quite an impression on the people who witnessed it. It was the talk amongst our circle of friends for at least a week. Oh, we had fun.
We had fun, yeah.
I suppose any house where the people are caught off guard and they are persuaded to become involved, and then when we leave, they don't notice us going because the party has taken off and people are entertaining themselves. And you are the reason that somebody has gotten up to play the piano or gone in and gotten the fiddle out. They start singing or playing or dancing, whatever the case may be, and you've been the catalyst for making their time memorable. That's what's nice about mummering, that perhaps you can give people a little gift that allows them to remember things about themselves as opposed to has them remember you.
I mean, how do you think of it in a time of, like, the internet and every kid in the world knows there's no Santa Claus or whatever, you know, like in a world where there's less magic, I guess, how do you rationalize the Mummers, and how do you rationalize doing this year after year after year? And I guess the best way I could think about it is that it's something that needs to be passed on. It's an important tradition that makes us who we are, you know? We shouldn't get roped up into Survivor and Britney Spears and all the rest. There's some thread, I think, that we should still keep with the past. We're slowly getting bombarded with all these other things that's drowning elements like Mummering out, but I think that we should still keep a thread so that we'll always have that. That's always something that we can say that's who we are, you know?
Something with some tech.